This is the Campus Governance Oral History Project. I'm interviewing Joe Ann Elder, who was instrumental in the early days of the development of the campus, of the Madison Era Academic Staff Association, and work with the ASEC committee. I wanted to ask a few things that we didn't touch on in our first interview. Joe, could you tell me about your job offer from the University of Madison, how you got started, who made the offer to you, and what your reaction was when you got the offer?
We were out east at Wesleyan for a semester or a year at a think tank where my husband was participating in a fellowship program. And I received a letter from the then chair of the sociology department asking if I would be interested in being a half-time academic advisor in sociology. At that time, I believe there were only two other such positions at the university. I think one was psychology and the other maybe social work. Mm-hmm. I said I would. Just before leaving for Connecticut, I had an offer to teach sociology in high school. And so at Wesleyan, I had started a secondary education degree course, which I actually finished when I came back to Madison. But at the end of my first year here, as working theoretically half-time as advisor in sociology, student advisor, they asked me if I would like to get paid for the full time I was putting in. So I said, sure, and the rest is history. I worked in that position for 30 years.
What did you perceive to be the expectations of the job when you took it, when you started?
Since it was a brand new position in the department, it kind of fell to my lot to develop the job. Of course, I kept folders on all the advisees. And then what were their needs? And I quickly developed a career shelf of career books and pamphlets and so forth. What can you do with a major in sociology, which is one of the first questions, especially their parents asked, what can you do with a major in sociology? And I developed quite a network of jobs that our majors went into. I developed information about graduate programs that spun off from either in sociology or a good spin-off from sociology, a number of administrative programs. And of course, our majors went into law and medicine also. Mm-hmm. But I even had one who became an equestrian trainer.
Is that right?
Like all jobs, I was given, maybe not all jobs at academic staff, I was given a great deal of leeway to develop the job and took that opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm. Why don't I follow up with that? You listed some of your responsibilities, and it sounds like you had freedom and flexibility. You had enough the kind of flexibility to develop the ways to meet the responsibilities of the job.
Yes, and one of the things about my job was that it did have outreach to other offices in the university, because students, of course, came from all over campus. Some of them were double majors. I worked with academic dean's office. I worked, of course, with library and placement, career placement. We had a double major in sociology and education, so I had to be familiar with the School of Education. Sociology and social work, sociology and psychology, sociology and political science, those were the most common double majors. So I had to develop interaction with all of those other departments and programs. And there was a large student personnel association on campus, which also helped me form a network of acquaintances on campus.
So you're sort of touching on this already, but you're saying, what was the campus, what was Madison like when you began working here? You have a lot of networks that you developed. Was that across the board? Did a lot of the departments and programs interact?
Not so much, but The other thing that's important to know that when we came here in 1960, this campus was half as big as it is today. And therefore, it was growing by year until it almost doubled in population. So programs were doubling. The size of programs, especially the size of academic staff, was doubling because the university was developing a very large research center. And as you know, we have one of the best research centers in the world here. So the size doubled in the next 15 years that I was on campus. And I was watching new buildings go up, but then a bigger demand for services.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see. That's good because I remember reading when we did a history of the graduate school and how the growth after World War II, of course,
right.
Things expand just sort of exploded as return
right.
vets came.
And this was then, part of that explosion.
And then, yeah. So and now we know today, 41,000 students, 41,000 plus. Tells us just where we are.
Our department has doubled in size since when I started.
Hmm.
At the sociology department. I think there were 15 faculty when we came, and there's certainly double that now.
And it's one of the top departments
in
the country.
And it's one of the best. We pride ourselves on being number one.
Yes, you are. I'm jumping back and forth, but I think this all ties in together. How closely aligned? You have a master's in sociology.
So I have a master's in soci and some work beyond.
So your graduate work was closely aligned with what you did for 30 years.
Yes, it did. It was.
Mm-hmm. Do you think?
I think I mentioned in yesterday's interview that I couldn't go on for my doctorate and teach in the same department right. because of the nepotism rules here. However, I encourage all other academic staff to complete their doctorate. I think it would have facilitated my career a bit.
And we're hoping times have changed now that women with husbands or faculty, spouses, can teach.
Today there are a lot of spousal hires. It's just the opposite of when I was here.
Mm-hmm. When do you
of
think
course, the nice thing about my being academic staff and my husband being faculty is that we did not interact with each other's salaries. In other words, he didn't have anything to do with mine and I didn't have anything to do with his.
That's a good point. Okay, let me get back to, I think I may have touched base on all that I wanted to make sure we covered on your position as an academic staff member. You and I started talking about, because of your history with governance, when I started here in 2001, that fall, and to this day, I receive a letter from the sitting chancellor that invites academic staff to participate in campus governance. In fact, you know, giving us permission, so to speak, to participate. And I think that's an interesting place to start today because it wasn't always that way.
It was certainly not. And when I started, there was almost no participation, quote, of academic staff itself. There were special people that had faculty status. I mentioned Emily Chervenik, I think, was director of placement. She had faculty status. There were half a dozen other faculty status people. I believe maybe Tom Hoover or the registrar of the university had faculty status. There were, faculty status simply meant that you could participate in faculty governance. It didn't give you much beyond that. But as far as everybody else was concerned, if you were not faculty, you were not a part of faculty governance. Now,
record.
Because I knew people all over campus I think we were more aware of wanting to be involved in campus decision making for some reason. The Madison Academic Staff Association, MASA, was formed, I think, in about 1975 or 1976. And one of my favorite issues of the Madison Academic Staff Association News was touting the election of the 11-member Academic Staff Advisory Committee that was going to happen in 1976. Now, the Madison Academic Staff Association was beginning to form. We had members from communicative disorders, from letters and science, a few specialists in the sciences. Certainly the librarians were a very active group. And I'd say lower administrators, not your top administrators, but perhaps your second line of administrators. But there was kind of a rumbling on campus that we ought to have some input into what goes on here at the university. And so that very first newsletter, I remember the Madison Academic Staff Association, which I refer to here always as MASA, they had a newsletter that said, "Who will speak for the academic staff when the UW system rules for non-faculty academic staff will be adopted?" And see, this happened, the university merged, oh dear, I should have that at my fingertips.
I believe you said 71.
71?
Yeah.
So the system, it was the early 70s, and we were going to merge the university into one university system. And so the legislature developed Chapter 36, and there was talk about a complete separation of faculty and academic staff, and the academic staff said, "Well, who will speak for us?" And MASA put out this newsletter that said, "Who will speak for you?" The best way to have your voice heard is to join an association of people to make your voice louder. And so we talked about MASA being an association of concerned, independently organized academic staff. It is not a union. Membership in MASA would not preclude membership in other organizations, such as the Specialist Organizing Committee, which was a small group of primarily scientists, specialists at that time, or United Faculty AFT Local 223, which was an established union on campus. But MASA's policies are meant to reflect your views and the views of all academic staff insofar as is humanly possible. MASA is intended to be an organization to which all academic staff can relate. And then we talked about what we'd already accomplished. We had already provided 500 signatures to a MASA petition to represent the academic staff interests at the May 8th Regents Education Committee meeting, and with some success. The chairman of this committee, John Levine, designated five areas in the system rules for further consideration and potential change, four of which exactly paralleled the four areas of concern represented in the MASA petition. Those were that the committee to work with a chancellor on development of procedures to implement the system rules on campus level to be entirely academic staff and entirely elected, but with faculty and administrative consultants, that fixed-term employees with more than 5 years service be accorded the minimum due process as described in UWS 11 and 12, that those with indefinite appointments have the right to appeal a chancellor's decision concerning termination or dismissal, that the campus rules developed by the Academic Staff Committee and the chancellor be submitted to the Board of Regents for approval. What are the issues? Under the rules outlined in the latest document recommended by Central Administration and the MEL document, which the Madison administration supports, the following conditions would exist. A committee to advise on campus rules could, at the chancellor's discretion, be composed of a bare majority of academic staff. The chancellor would have final absolute authority over the setup of a grievance procedure, and so forth. I'm shortening the list here, but in other words, it was not a democratic procedure for academic staff people. There was very little input from the academic staff itself. So, what can you do? We said in that May Massa newsletter, you can communicate. Communicate first with us, and we will help you communicate to the powers that be. So that was the beginning of the organization of the Madison Academic Staff Association. We spent hours getting organized. We spent hours writing long rules and regulations, and this is the way it should be, and so forth. But we did have an impact, and one of the things I was impressed about with MASA, we weren't afraid to go to the top. And I remember one meeting, we invited Chancellor Shane to come and speak to us. And I'd like to quote a little bit from what Chancellor Shane said, and this was January 1978. He attended the steering committee of MASA. We asked him hard questions, and we received very thoughtful answers. We gave a brief history of MASA, and ascertained and asked him his views of academic staff. We were pleased. He seemed to value the role of academic staff professionals. He's concerned, as we are, about the meaningless labels carried by academic staff. That is, 90% of us were, quote, specialists. Including the hat check girl at the union, as I have often said in previous times. He seemed to feel that there should be a much wider use of the indefinite appointment than the previous administration indicated. He said there should be career ladders and proper pay scales, and there should be more use of the indefinite appointment for long-term professionals. So that was music to our ears. Later, an interested group of academic staff published in 1998 a document called A Vision Shared. And this is an excellent document in terms of commenting on the current makeup of academic staff, its diversity, academic staff qualifications, and the mosaic of necessary personnel to fill the requirements of teaching and research. And it details in that document the current status of academic staff today, which is very good. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to think that we had a heavy hand in getting things organized way back when.
I think so.
MASA had the advantage and used it to invite knowledgeable members of the academic staff to share their expertise with us. Robert Nygaard was pay benefits supervisor and wrote an issue of the MASA newsletter about new information on fringe benefits for academic staff. Some of our editors were professional writers with timely access to new developments on campus. And so we took advantage of these knowledgeable people to help us get the word out to academic staff about what's going on, what their rights and privileges were, mm-hmm. how they could get elected and should stay informed on the issues, mm-hmm. how they can affect input into their salary evaluations. Unfortunately, most departments were on the up and up with their personnel policies, but I heard a lot of complaints, especially in the specialist category that was in the sciences and in research. There are all levels of research, of course, from the top brilliant PhD designer of the research down to the little guy that turns the screw and makes sure that the all these people, especially at the lower level, were called specialists, and many of them felt that there were no adequate evaluations of their work, and in at least two instances, I discovered that there were double files kept, one under the desk and one above the desk, which at least in two cases that I could delineate, which I won't, led to the firing of the individual, and I didn't think those were fair practices.
Did you, as you were in your position or in sociology in your department for 30 years, were you, did you follow then the growth of the Academic Staff Association? You were an active member for many years.
All the years that I was there, I was a member, and most active, of course, in the 70s. I was elected to the Academic Staff Committee, and I chaired that committee for a couple of years. When I was chair of the committee, it was a partly elected and partly appointed committee. They knew that I was also a member of United Faculty AFT, and at least there were a couple of administrators who were very suspicious of anything I did. And, you know, I think of myself as a fair and nice person, but I did not get that treatment from, I will not name the chancellor at the time. They were adamant that I never met with the committee outside of the committee meeting. And they were monitoring anything that I said very carefully. It did put me on edge at times because it kept me from speaking my mind when maybe it should have been spoken.
Did you ever consider not pursuing it? Did you ever feel that?
You mean calling people up on the phone and talking behind?
Yeah, and going ahead with the development of the committee.
Well, let's say it wasn't impossible. But it was too bad. Yeah. I felt that lack of trust, and I didn't think it was warranted. I mean, I think we could have exchanged comments on a collegial basis, and I didn't feel I was treated as a colleague, but by at least one of the chancellors. Mm-hmm. Another, like Chancellor Shane, was very good.
Mm-hmm. So as administrations changed, or as the top changed,
right? Yeah.
You started seeing more and more support of what you were doing.
I think so. Actually, Shane preceded a less supportive person. But I think that some people are terribly afraid of unions. Now, I've not ever been terribly afraid of unions. It seems to me that people who pull together in an organized fashion have the advantage of standing as a block of organized people. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But there are certain business models that are very afraid of unions, feeling that they are democratic and that's not always good for business. And that's even true, I think, of certain administrators. Mm-hmm. When they see unions can be arbitrary, there's no doubt about that. On the other hand, they try to be democratic. My experience with unions have been that they have been democratic. So, but there is that tension, and there is a tension, I think. I think maybe we discussed this before, that it's somewhat of a class issue. And since I was raised in a union family, I was not afraid of what a union meant. But certainly the United Faculty and Academic Staff, that union of faculty, was very, well, it included academic staff in the second trimester of my time on campus, and it was very supportive of the academic staff.
But MASA itself was not, and never would be, a union.
MASA said, we are not a union, we are an organization. And if you want to join a union, there are two unions, or three, that you can choose from. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But people observe this organization as union potential. And there were always people who were frightened of that.
Was there a little less fear as you went ahead and did your work and identified the areas that you could work or help decide policy or work on policy and procedure?
I think MESA developed a very good reputation as being an organization that looked at the facts, presented them in a fair and accurate manner, tried to keep itself informed of personnel policies as they were happening, and therefore I think won the respect of a large number of campus people. Of course, I haven't been on campus for 10 years, but I think with email, communication should be much easier today than it was when we had to write these newsletters, print them, and send them out to campus. You know, it was a big victory when we got a campus permit to use campus mail.
Okay. You were paying for it all by the $5 dues membership?
Yes,
fee?
The MESA kept its $5 dues for many years, and I'm not sure what they are today, but
it's
I don't think
now.
They're only 10 today. Now, you know, for do you know what the Wisconsin University Union dues are?
I don't.
I'm not sure either, but I do know that AFT, Local 223, mm-hmm. takes a percentage of your salary.
Yeah,
that's much more expensive for the average academic staff person.
But they're very, very involved in working with the legislature. And
right.
So
and that in a state university is very important. Mm-hmm. And as you could see from many of our early MESA newsletters, we kept on top of that, what's going on at the state level, and especially after Chapter 36, when we all became one big university. It's always been a tug and pull with the legislature to treat the Madison campus fairly as a flagship campus. Mm-hmm. And we do have very different problems than the state universities, especially our research wing. And the size itself makes us have different problems. Because we have to have more support services. With 40,000 students, mm-hmm. you have to have a large placement office. You have to have more deans, more academic deans. You have to have more admissions people. Just the superstructure of such a large university demands more people.
What was the climate like right after the merger? I mean, did people really didn't know exactly what was going, how things were going to change, did they? I mean, they could anticipate.
No. I think there were a lot of nervous Nellies out there worrying about what would happen to this flagship campus. Mm-hmm. I think when you get to know people, you know, the fact that the academic staff was working with administration that saw them as real people, nice people, intelligent people, not people who wanted to tear down the place, but to build up the place, to make the place. In other words, I think when everybody discovered that we had the same value system, we wanted more and better for everybody, and what we needed was to give more job support in many different ways, not only salary, but in terms of long-term support. Not everybody could have an indefinite appointment, but they developed rolling horizon mm-hmm. appointments. So there were many ways to solve this problem of insecurity and to reward people that should be rewarded for their outstanding work. And I think that was in the interest of everybody.
Was there any interaction between Madison academic staff and the other state schools?
There wasn't an all-state organization. Actually, there are a number of all-state organizations. but nothing exactly like the like we formed on in Mesa.
Okay. All right, we're recording.
One of the problems, especially with the public, has been the definition of academic staff. And that little article that I wrote, a letter to the editor, was exactly defining what was the academic staff at that time. The Wisconsin, in 1985, there were enabling bills introduced in the legislature dealing with trying to delineate what was academic staff on campuses. Governor Earle established a task force on comparable worth, which had to deal also with academic staff and, of course, with comparable worth for women employees. Shane did an 85 review of the system's academic staff. Shane did a review of academic staff on this campus in response to the system's review of academic staff. In 1984, there was an academic staff salary study committee on this campus, and seven major categories of academic staff were delineated, and Shane urged all of these be eligible for catch-up pay, and that the academic staff itself be involved in the distribution of catch-up. These are all rather revolutionary was much appreciated by academic staff. And again, the Madison Academic Staff Association was publishing newsletters about these issues, mm-hmm. and saying, if you have an opinion, voice it, and here's the way you can voice your opinion. And I think we did a good job of spelling out what the problems were and urging people to do that. You know, our dues were only $5, so I think people who were members of the Madison Academic Staff Association got a lot for their money. For the first time that at campus, all election campus, on this campus, of seven candidates to the 11-member Academic Staff Committee, it was Massa who held the candidate forums and published the views of the candidates. Actually, it was Massa who scouted out people who to run for these offices. We mentioned the fact that Chapter 36 was amended to give the academic staff the right to develop policies and personnel matters affecting themselves, subject to the Board of Regents, President, Chancellor, and faculty. And getting organized and recognized has been the continuous effort of the academic staff, and especially Massa, in urging the academic staff on to do these things. And now, of course, the Academic Staff Committee, and you have multiple committees that have branched out from the Academic Staff Committee. So you've really taken over the work of the Madison Academic Staff Association.
Excellent.
But it still exists.
It does.
Still,
mm-hmm.
It still has
it
a newsletter. And
yes, and then they do hold their elections. And in fact, a few Massa members were just now elected to the ASEC committee.
Uh-huh.
So there's still that going on.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's really great. Okay. So it wasn't until 85 that the Wisconsin University Union was formed, but that was in response to not wanting to pay the high dues of UFAFT.
Okay.
So we have some overlapping organizations there.
And that was a union that staff could join?
Yes.
Okay.
Wisconsin University a Union was a union for both academic staff and faculty, but it really made its pitch to academic staff.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay. In 1980, there were 2,175 faculty, 7,748 classified staff and 3,475 academic staff. That was in 1980. I'd be curious to know what those numbers are today.
I want to say that there are, I don't know why I want to say this, but 7,000 academic staff?
Almost double,
I think
that
almost
number.
Double that number.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. And I have a chart of the various titles and breakdown, but I don't have it in front of, I don't have it
mm-hmm.
with me. But yeah, it's quite amazing.
If you find that, you might want to turn on this particular interview and spell it out.
Good point. Let's see. Actually, this is a fact sheet.
Oh, good.
This is one that came just, that's current, that's fairly current. And this sheet we're looking at is the UW-Madison Academic Staff Fact Sheet. Who are the academic staff? Do you want to?
Approximately 6,762 academic professionals in higher education with responsibility for carrying out instructional, research, and public service mission of this major university system. Of this group, a majority hold advanced degrees of master's, PhD, JD, and so forth. That surprises me. Not of those 6,000, I don't think so. They all have to have a minimum of a bachelor's.
Right. I was surprised to hear that as well. I heard that at one of our forums, that most hold at least the master's degree.
Academic staff were either principal investigators or co-principal investigators for research projects that brought in more than $67 million to the UW-Madison.
Yeah, that was in 2001 and 2002, yeah.
Academic staff perform a wide range of functions in instruction, research, student services, administration, clinical health services, computer information processing, communications, and facilities management.
That hasn't changed a lot.
No.
From your days.
70% are involved in instruction or research. So I was part of that 30% as an advisor.
As an advisor. And here's some of the functions, again, this was from last October. And so our head count is 7,291 total of academic staff. So, like you said, it's grown quite a bit.
And it should be publicized, you know, occasionally. That's what I tried to do in that little article. Do you have that, Annie?
I think I do, yeah.
That I wrote for the newspaper way back.
Here we go.
An article I wrote for the Capital Times, September 18th, 1976, talked about when you read about academic staff on the Madison campus, you probably think of faculty. Technically, the words academic staff means professional and administrative personnel other than faculty and classified staff. You may be surprised to learn that academic staff number about 3,100 persons and faculty about 2,200. This large group of persons has almost no input into university decision-making and very little control over its own destiny. And so it went in 1976. So we've come a long way.
You certainly have. That was the beginnings, early days. Now, you also have just to step back just a second, you have a Capital Times article there about the merger itself, a kind of an outsider look at our university merger.
Capital Times, Monday, April 9th, 1973. The new University of Wisconsin system raised some concerns that the great centralization of authority, which was likely in such a system, would destroy too much autonomy of individual campuses. It's really a question of whether different campuses at that time had different foci, I guess. And of course, Madison was the leading center of research and graduate education. And there was a lot of concern that this campus would lose prestige, which was clearly not true. But it it did create the climate for equalizing personnel practices, and that turned out to be a benefit for mm-hmm. academic staff.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right, here we go. Joanne, you have I want to refer back to the article you wrote in 1976 for the Capital Times about academic staff, and it seems like you have a good way to summarize what we've been talking about.
The last couple of paragraphs read like this: "We don't question the preeminence of the faculty in making policy. We object to having no voice at all. We are grateful to share faculty fringe benefits like health care. We resent the paternal attitude that decisions are made for us and not with us. MESA feels non-faculty professionals on the Madison campus could contribute valuable expertise by serving on appropriate committees and being represented in governance. Our advice is rarely sought, and our rewards for doing good work are minimal. You are paying for a quality institution, and such an institution can best prosper if it fully uses its resources like us." I wrote that in 1976. Meanwhile, a lot of good things have happened. A lot of equality has come around to the academic staff. And I don't know, does it have anywhere to go?
There's always room for growth, isn't there?
Always room for growth.
Trying to get everyone to understand that MASA and the organization is for them, and that to participate in campus governance is really a way to, as you've said, get your voice heard and to have a part in what we do day to day, what affects us day to day.
What affects you, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed
it. It's been fun going back over the historical path here.
And I've learned a lot.
Me too.